All right, gentlemen, how's it going?
What's up?
Good evening.
All right, so what did we all have for dinner tonight?
This is a big topic. Yeah, I haven't eaten yet, but I went to the store right before this and I got some salad greens and chicken. So I'm going to have make myself a chicken salad, which is very healthy and responsible.
What did you scrounge up over there? You're sending these like shots of
strip mall food.
That Indian Bros restaurant looked pretty good. I mean, it didn't look good for you, but like that butter chicken burrito or whatever.
I feel like that would be, I was tempted to go there because there's, you know, okay. So there's Chinese food, right? And there's so many different categories of Chinese food. And I think like American Chinese food is just kind of one of those categories now. So why couldn't it be the same with Indian food?
It's like a province of China.
Yes, it's like Toronto or Brampton is soon going to be a province of India.
Why shouldn't
there should just be like Bramptonian Indian food. It might be very good. Look, every culture in the world has some kind of chicken and sauce and rice mixed together with vegetables. And it's always good.
These they're called Frankie rolls. They have a bro bowl, butter chicken bowl, and Frankie rolls, tandoori chicken Frankie. Butter paneer Frankie, and they're wrapped in these like
either Indian chicken wraps, basically.
Yeah, and they're wrapped in like a naan type bread, and it looks pretty boss, man.
It looks pretty hearty.
It did look pretty good, but like
it looks good in the junk food sense of the word.
Exactly,
it's like massively loaded down with sugar and carbs, and like fried chicken.
Yeah. Also, like around this area of town where my parents live, it's like. If you see a restaurant on Google and it's 4 stars, it's actually only 3.5, right? And in like the normal Toronto scale. So you got to deduct, right?
What is up with this? You know, it's funny. You want to inquire about doomerism. What is up with this doomerism where you simply posted a photo of a restaurant in Toronto?
Yeah.
And Mike goes all in on it. Like, what the fuck? That is so depressing. What is it, 1987? By the way, 1987 was a great year. I don't know why you're dogging 1987.
The strip mall looks straight out of the 80s. 1987.
Like, that strip mall looks like every place in LA.
Okay, but it's what's inside that counts. And what's inside is still 19. Like, it's still 1987.
Yeah, look at the inside of that restaurant. It looks
that like, Indian restaurant that looks like every Indian restaurant. In New York City.
That's not an Indian. That photo.
Yeah, that
of,
was
like,
a different place.
Okay.
Yeah. Like that. The one with the red.
I went to a Chinese restaurant for lunch last week that looked exactly like this, and it was great. It was a Peking duck house.
I actually believe that.
I loved it.
You can find gems like that. However, look, this is the restaurant in question that we are talking about is like a Canadian food restaurant.
Okay, I would eat there. Like they have booths.
I know they have
those like semicircular booths and where they would like bring the telephone to you when someone called you at the restaurant.
Yeah. And they would have hamburgers and beer. And that's fine. Again, it's fine in like the junk food category. I would go there.
I'm just saying you guys are super down. All it is a shopping center. And you guys are down on it. And you want to know why I'm doomer?
Yeah,
it's depressing. It just looks like everything else. And it looks like it's 30 years out of date.
It is 30 years
out of date. It's America. That's Canada. We're 30 years out of date.
Well, okay. No,
yeah, maybe that's what I'm really saying.
Every time I walk by that place, it is it's 100% 55 and up white people in there in Toronto. This never happens. This never happens in Toronto in 2023.
Okay. Oh, well, okay.
And there's nothing wrong with that. It's just like, it's just a different vibe.
Yeah, it's right? Super, super like how it used to be in 1987. Yes,
exactly. Yeah. It's a time capsule. I could go in there. I'm sure it'd be fine. And I'd just be like, yeah, okay. And I would be fine if that's kind of like you've gone to Germany and you've gone to a pub in Germany or like a beer house and you're having some bratwurst and lager. And like you're a tourist. And be like, oh, yeah, look at these locals. They're look at the food.
Jesus.
Okay, this is cool. But the fire, it was like, I actually live nearby. And that's weird.
I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think what's the most depressing thing is to take like a random a random exit off the New Jersey Turnpike.
Yeah.
And go to like the Dollar Tree.
Yeah.
To look for a bathroom.
That is super depressing.
Yeah. Which I've done before. And Dollar, let me tell you, the Dollar General or the Dollar Trees in America, bro. Oh my God. It's, you know, and I think Dollar Tree is now the largest retailer in America in terms of number of stores. And
everywhere.
Yeah. Like what the picture that you posted is pretty highbrow compared to what
maybe we should
a
be
lot
more
of America looks like, dude. Yeah, I don't know why you think I'm the doomer, you know, about America or whatever.
Well, okay. Admittedly, I have not.
Oh, I had hot pot, by the way. I had the first hot pot of the season at home. I don't go out for hot pot. And it was amazing. It always means that, I don't know, fall, tomorrow I think is the first day of fall.
Yes.
And it's, you know, I don't know. It's the best season.
I do like fall.
I just drove by UCLA today and they're like doing some kind of dorm move-in or something.
Yeah.
So it's definitely fall. Ball is in the air.
Did you guys like in college when, like September in college?
Oh, yeah. It's exciting. You see all your friends again.
Yeah.
You got a new schedule.
Yeah. It's not like scorching hot. Well, maybe it is in LA, but like it's not scorching hot where I went to school.
And then you see your new classes and you're like, I'm going to learn something.
Like, shit, things are getting back.
So in Southern California, it's actually when the weather starts turning cold and damp. So it was fun in the sense that like we could see our friends again and it was back to social time with everyone. Yeah. But the general feeling of the season was not that great.
Really?
Yeah.
Like fall in California is not a good season?
Well, no, because spring and summer are the peak. Right. And then it kind of just goes down into winter
because you don't have that seasonal culture where on the East Coast we get all excited for fucking, you know, leaves.
We don't have
and then, you know, I don't know, whatever people do, sipping hot cider.
It just gets cold and foggy instead of sunny and awesome.
Everyone on the East Coast, we all have, you know, tractors and hayrides and shit.
Yeah. I mean, we had some of that stuff when we were a kid, but probably not to the same extent.
It's just the whole vibe. Like autumn in the East Coast is just the whole fucking
also,
vibe.
Also, when I was a kid, dude, it used to rain a lot more in California. So that's when the rain would come also. And it's starting to turn again. Like these days it rains a lot more. Like the last 2 or 3 years, it's rained a shitload in California.
A little bit of rain's not bad though.
So yeah, it was just different.
So there is that.
I imagine though that for people who grew up in California but went to school on the East Coast, went to college on the East Coast, it would be super exciting because they get to go back to the East Coast and like start that whole process over again in winter wonderland.
This is going to sound like a really dumb question, but do you guys have do the leaves change color in California?
Yeah, we have some of that, but it's mainly like evergreens and palm trees.
Oh, okay.
So we have some like aspen kind of trees, but they, you know, like the leaves are orange and red for like a week and then they're just gone.
Okay.
They don't stay for like weeks or anything.
Yeah. East Coast fall is nice for that kind of stuff. But alas.
It's just not the same when it doesn't snow. It just gets foggy and cold and shitty and damp. So it's, you know, it's not quite as elevated of a season. It's more just like downtime. Yeah. Sorry, not to kill the mood.
No, man. It's all good. But so what was the question of the day? Like about this doomerism?
Oh, okay. Well, so I mean, last couple of times we've talked, I felt that teen, you've gotten into a headspace where you're like very, very pessimistic about the state of affairs in the U.S.
Yeah.
And I think to my mind, and even as somebody who is like, I think probably not to, I mean, in the simplest terms, like not a shit lib probably, like an excessive degree of doomerism to me. Right.
Mm.
And
I'm not saying the US is going to collapse or anything.
Well, but sure. But like even this sort of like I think there was one as an example. Right. You said that probably the median Chinese person has like a better a more fulfilling life or a better life than the median American.
No. I didn't say that. I said that the median Chinese household in mainland China has, on a PPP basis, more wealth, like multiples more wealth than the median American household. That's not a vibe. That's a fact.
I would like to see the numbers on
that. I can find that for you. I saw it on Twitter. It must be true.
So wait, that takes into account like savings and all that, right?
Yeah, it's a net worth figure.
It's a net worth thing. Okay. Yeah. Well, yeah, of course. Like China has a savings culture and America doesn't.
Yeah,
so up to their eyeballs in debt.
But the part that was really sad was, if you look at the average number, of course, America's average household wealth is many multiples higher than the average Chinese household.
Right, which means, because of the extremes. Yeah.
We are just extremely unequal.
Right.
You know, China's wealth distribution is not, you know.
Yeah, I would be interested to know how that has changed in China over the last 10 years since
the
Xi Jinping got into power, right? Like his whole thing was like bringing back some aspects of socialism that were on the way out previously. So I would be interested to see how the wealth disparity in China has gone over the last few years. I don't know if any of their official data can, I mean,
totally rely. Yeah. And it's also like, how do you value, the thing is, there's still so many people in China that are like actually poor, right? Like from an income standpoint. Like, I don't know the numbers offhand, but like the number of people who are living on RMB a month or something like that.
Yeah, they're just like straight up
hundreds of millions of people still, right?
Yeah, they're either just like farming the fields or construction workers in giant cities.
And then you kind of have to like come up with a value for like the land that they quote unquote own and the house that they quote unquote own. It's a tough comparison to make, right? Because like, what is that shack worth out in the countryside?
I'm just saying the three of us are not in a position to compare the median American life because we don't live that life.
We are clearly
on the upper end of the skew. That's just the fact.
But median American life, you're not talking like 10th percentile. You're talking 50th percentile.
Right in the middle.
Right in the middle. Yeah. But like, what does that look like? That's, I think,
poorer than your average Chinese family in material terms.
Well, I think the biggest, I'm not like super in touch with either of these hypothetical families, but I think the biggest difference is just going to be financial stress, right? Whether or not they can get their hands on actual food and furniture and all that kind of shit is probably pretty comparable because of the way that this stuff is distributed, but I think the American family is going to be under much more like actual financial stress where they have to worry about like the numbers on a week to week or month to month basis.
Yeah. Look, here's another example is I posted on Twitter about how I had to get my four brake rotors changed. Uh-huh. That's not a huge job. You know,
you just
switch out the rotors and the pads.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
It was $900 to do all four. I had an oil change too, but it parts and labor.
This was on the you have a RAV4?
Yeah, CRV.
Okay. CRV,
same,
okay.
Same deal.
Okay.
And it was a pretty, it was a pretty fair price.
Yeah,
right?
Sounds about right.
About right. Right.
$900. Yeah.
Well, the Fed says that your average American family cannot pay out of pocket for a $1,000 emergency. And so I posted that because I heard that was a well-known thing that They've surveyed Americans, and I think over 50% said that they would rely on a credit card balance or something like that to pay for it.
Yeah,
they didn't have the cash on hand.
Yeah, so that kind of expense would be they would either put it on a credit card if they absolutely had to do it, like the brakes were making a terrible racket or something like that, and they knew for a fact that it was a danger to them, like it's just super obvious. They
couldn't put it off anymore.
Yeah, they couldn't put it off. Mm-hmm. I think they would stick it on a credit card. If it wasn't super obvious that it was a dangerous thing, then they would probably just forego it or get a set of like used rotors or something.
Or like machine the rotors themselves.
Machine the rotors.
Weird, like
something
unsafe.
Ideal. Something unsafe, basically.
So I posted this and someone responded to me. They're like, bullshit. I just looked it up. The average family in America has $41,600 in transactional accounts, right? Either a brokerage account or a banking account or whatever.
Yeah.
Okay, they're correct.
The average American.
The average is 41. The average amount in the household's transactional accounts is $41,600, just like that person said. But the median is $5,300.
Yeah. Okay.
So
yeah,
again, I mean, when you see these huge differences in the average versus median number, you know, it just tells you just how bad the skew is.
Yeah. If the average is 10 times the median, that is quite.
Yeah.
No disagreement on the distributional matter, but if the median American has $5,300 US in their checking account, is this like family or individual?
I don't know it's a household.
It's a household? Okay.
Yeah, and I don't know what is meant exactly by transactional accounts. That may include
like mutual funds and stuff.
Yeah. Like, you know, yeah. Or something like that. Sure. I don't know, but it's the median is $5,300.
Right. That just means not retirement, I think.
Okay, so but like liquidish.
Liquid. They're $5,300 of liquidity is for median.
That's like
one big.
More than that's probably more than like global average GDP, global median GDP per capita.
You know, but that's the shit. That is the shit lib view. Is like but it's more than the
No, it's like I'm just saying like
but you can't. Americans these people can't. Well. Americans can't even afford a fucking brake job, dude.
Yeah, but you have a car.
You have to have a car. You have to have a car.
Yes.
It's not a luxury in America. You have to, because you're going to sleep in it probably.
Jesus. Okay, sure. Yes. But think about the GDP that you're generating from that car.
Yeah, see, that's the thing. I think that here's my doomerism, man.
Yeah.
It's not really like a numerical thing, right?
Feeling. No, I
doomerism that I have about America is that we're a heathen culture. And I don't trust the generation that we're raising to become the leaders of like the society, because the ones we have in place are already pretty fucking bad. And look at the son of the look at Hunter Biden, dude. That's what we're facing.
He's not Gen Z.
Look at Donald Trump Jr. Okay,
hookers and blow. Yeah,
yeah. That's what we're talking about. Okay.
Yeah.
I don't trust. One of the things that I really don't trust is our not just our education systems and like the reading and writing, but like the belief systems, the cultural values and stuff. It's really shockingly corrupt, you know, like American culture, if you're really honest about it. See, if you're not looking at it through rose-colored glasses or ignoring stuff and looking at cherry-picked numbers to say, no, we're fine.
Yeah, I mean, I think at this point, nobody thinks we're fine. It's sudden. I mean, it's been dawning on us for the past 3 or 4 years that everything's not fine. Right.
Yeah.
And I think the question is, okay, to what extent is it not fine? I mean, like, you know, people like Nancy Pelosi are just openly insider trading all day long. So it obviously goes to the very top, but I guess the question is, has it always been like this? And now we just know about it?
No, I don't think it has been. I really don't think the country was this bad off, and it's not surprising. I mean, like, you brought up the fourth, the turning stuff last time.
Yeah,
I was thinking about it. It was like an 80-year cycle, right?
Yeah,
80 years is approximately sort of three generations.
It's three generations and one long human life.
You would date from 1945, essentially, right? That would be the roughly the correct time to.
Yeah, because that was the end of the last fourth turning.
Yeah.
Approximately 80-year cycle.
So he's, you know, but the point being that it's roughly three generations. And there's a Chinese saying, "Fu bu guo san dai," which means that you're basically like a family cannot stay rich for more than three generations.
Yeah.
And look, man, there's the generation that built it, then there's the generation that inherits it, and then there's the generation that destroys it.
Squanders it,
and that's where we are.
Yeah, I mean that's kind of like a folksy thing in American culture too, like a folksy.
Yeah, was it rags to rags in three generations? Is the
yeah exactly
version of it?
It's kind of true.
I'm with you on a cultural standpoint. Like I do think that American culture and politics is getting really shit, just like really shit, really complete shit. People are combative and see like political affiliation, which is not political party affiliation, I don't think is like a catch-all for all politics, but is a very, very good proxy. I've seen numbers where it is viewed as being like more important than religion, or as like more of a thing that you identify with versus religion now, or even ethnicity. Right.
Sorry, wait. What is more than religion?
Political party. What sort of thing do people identify with the most? And political party is like has shot up from kind of low. Like, you know, the other selections being religion, gender, ethnicity, what class, whatever, right? And political party has shot way up as like being the primary sort of identity politics dimension, the primary dimension of that.
Okay, that's fine. But I mean, we've always had like cultural bifurcation in America between roughly, we used to say North and South, but now it's really like urban and rural. And that's been in play for a long time.
Yeah.
Has it gotten worse? Maybe.
Religion and gender and race.
Can I go gloves off here for a sec and explain to you why I think at heart you are a shitlib? And it has nothing to do with your attitudes about you know, China or Russia.
Yeah.
I think you have a shitlib core because you're an asset manager. And and no, hear me out. This is not a personal attack. This is a well-reasoned argument.
That's fine.
You're a shitlib at heart because you're an asset manager guy and you pay attention to markets.
Yes.
And markets are just a giant price signal computer, right? It's a collective price signal hyper intelligence. Yes. It's not an artificial intelligence, but it is a collective intelligence. And the attitude, I think, of a lot of people who work in a place where CNBC is on all the time, you know, that kind of thing, or where you have access to a Bloomberg terminal, you know, that kind of thing, which is all of New York City. It becomes a sort of like religion, and we don't notice this, but I think that the idea that the market and all of its endlessly complex price signals, there is deep, deep, deep information and truth in that. And, you know, it's kind of above all of us. Like, you know, the idea that any one of us could even make sense out of those signals would elevate us to the level of oracle, right? Like, you should make loads and loads of money if you can decode the signal that this hyperintelligence is trying to convey to us. Meaning, I think we're just really enthralled by numbers. And so when we talk about the health of the country or we talk about the health of society, we look at the markets. And if the markets aren't flashing red to us, if the stock market isn't crashing, you know, if yields aren't spiking, which they are and kind of is on the other side too.
Yeah.
But the number, like, we don't believe anything until the numbers say it's true. And, you know, I have to think that the numbers actually are a lagging indicator in many ways, not a leading indicator. And we have more control over those numbers than we think we do. And so I'm just saying that I think you're looking for objectivity when it comes to this doomerism, whereas I'm just saying, like, I'm it's a vibe for me. It's not
vibes. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's
okay.
What I'm trying to say is, like, you're still looking for hardcore evidence of collapse. And I'm saying,
No. I'm not asking for collapse here. Now, I may be a shitlib at heart. I am an asset manager.
You're a market shitlib. You're not a geopolitics shitlib. You're a markets shitlib.
A market shitlib.
Yeah. Numbers guy.
I guess my point is that while I agree with you on the fact that, or on the view that America is certainly in a decay process of some sort, the point from which America is starting is so fucking high that your nose is still bleeding. And it's going to be a long, long way before, you know, even if it's heading down, it's still really freaking good. Even for the median person versus the median person in a lot of other countries.
Then why are we having deaths of despair? Why are we having a massive, massive wave of opium addiction, basically?
Yes.
Why are we having falling life expectancies? Why are we having educational standards that are absolutely collapsing? I mean, like, you saw that. Did you see that Associated Press report about how college educators, first year college educators, are absolutely shocked that the things that college freshmen, and I'm talking at pretty good universities like George Mason University or like Rutgers, respectable four-year colleges.
Yeah.
They can't add fractions, dude. One of the women who was teaching first-year math for STEM majors said that she had a small class. This is admittedly a remedial class, but these people got into college. And she says the question she had was, what was 6 subtracted from -8 equal? And she said, not only were all their answers wrong, none of them were even the same. They can't do adding negative. And subtracting. They can't deal with negative numbers.
That's to be clickbait. That's to be clickbait.
That's not clickbait. Well, that's truth, man.
Well, think about it this way, right? Like, if you consider the fact that the average size of the student body at all these colleges has gone up tremendously over the last 20 years or so, it would make sense that
the
given
average gone down.
Yeah, I mean, it's not the average necessarily.
Dude,
it's just that there's just way more
fractions.
Remedial.
They can't add fractions, dude.
Like when I went to school in 2001, my freshman year, I knew people who had to go to remedial like classes like that at UC San Diego, which is like one of the best schools in California. So
that's not really making me feel better about it.
I know. What I'm saying though is there's a bigger incentive these days to like get these kids into school because of various reasons that have to do with funding and politics. Yeah. But I think all these people have always been there. Like there's always people that like a huge fraction of society just doesn't know math at all.
Well, they shouldn't be majoring in STEM fields at, you know, brand name universities.
They're going to drop out. I mean, they're not going to make it.
Well, they should have dropped out in high school.
To go and get like a $400,000 a year tech job now, right? Like, so it's just a kind of a sign of the times, but.
Let's not pretend that the system of education in America is normal. It's terrible. Everyone knows this. This is not a secret.
Just as unequal as a wealth distribution. I'll put it that way. Just as unequal as the wealth distribution. So,
well, it's not good.
No, but it's great at the high end.
I'm just saying that, you know, a lot of the indicators of social health are doing badly, even if the stock market hasn't collapsed or bond market's still relatively stable.
I agree with that. I just think a lot of it has to do with the fact that most people in college, I'm gonna go out on a limb and say most as in more than 50% of the people in college should not be in college. Yeah. They should be doing something else.
They should be like a vocational school or something like that.
Something, just anything. Just whatever. You know, like.
But that's fine. How are people graduating high school in the first place not knowing how to add fractions? I mean, we're not talking anything terribly difficult here. It's like 1/3 plus 1/2, you know, that kind of thing.
If a GED is by definition equivalent to a high school diploma. So if they can get a GED, they have a high school diploma. And whether or not they get into a college, there's no test. They just get in. Like somebody allows them to go, right? And then somebody else allows them to go.
Well, I think it means that the schools are just passing them along and giving them inflated grades because they don't want to deal with them. They don't want to deal with it.
Yeah.
Yeah, they don't want to actually educate people, so they put them in the system.
Right, and everyone is teaching to the metric. Every institution is just trying to pass itself off as numerically and empirically normal, but there's so much fraud. And I think education is an example where they're passing kids that are functionally illiterate.
I mean, they were,
and they're just passing them because they're like, well, if we don't pass them, we're going to look like we're fucked up.
I mean, part of the reason why I didn't really try that hard in college was because of the part of my compulsory education was a bunch of like super left wing political stuff. And like even when I was 18 years old and I really was not even politically aware or active, I kind of knew it was BS because I would write these essays and they wouldn't actually grade what I wrote. They would just grade it to some rubric that somebody had made up. So, I mean, I think to a certain extent, these huge public institutions especially are really just like kind of diploma mills. And in the last 20 years, the amount of public funding for, you know, loans and the fucking KPI-ification of education has really given all these institutions an incentive just to grow bigger and bigger and bigger and like kind of push people through, you know, because that's how they get their funding. And that's how everyone kind of just keeps going along
and,
this.
And that's path. That's my fear is that America's problem is this sort of like, you're right. I think that the institutional architecture of America is very solid and sturdy. America is a very overbuilt kind of society. And, you know, you can make fun of our lack of maintenance on the infrastructure, but that shit was built over spec. And, you know, it lasts way longer than, like, it has any right to. You know, like, we're, like, you make fun of the New York City subway. I'm like, this thing's been basically unmaintained for 100 years. And it's still fucking running.
Yeah, the problem is it still works.
Yeah, it's still fucking works. I don't know what the fuck they were building this stuff out of pure iron or something, but it still fucking works. And so I think you're right. There's a structural solidity to America. It is very solid. But the problem is that we're coming apart. We're starting to fade at, like, the cellular level. You know what I mean? Like, it's not a catastrophic structural problem that I'm talking about. It's just this general fading of something, like spirit or some shit. Like, you know, we're in the third generation, man. And, you know, we're beyond the shelf life, I think, of what is the word, like, the vibrancy or something, like the
expiration date.
Yeah, but like, we're just not. It's just people don't give a fuck.
People
just don't give a fuck. They don't give a fuck about anything,
right? You're in the ennui phase, where you're just like, yeah.
This is beyond ennui, man. I had ennui as a kid, growing up in the burbs. Every fucking American suburban teenager had American suburban ennui, and that's why we listened to the shit that we did, right? I mean, every suburban kid was listening to, like, Green Day or something, yeah? Dealing with suburban ennui. I'm talking about, like, a loss of life force. And I think COVID, you know, after COVID, I think the big effect of COVID, you know, not just the virus, but, like, the whole event.
Yeah.
I think the country's just exhausted. I just get this general sense of just exhaustion. And I never thought about that, but I'm like, maybe exhaustion is something that can happen to, like, a whole civilization. It's like a civilizational exhaustion.
I mean, I think the fact that it's super hard to get ahead, right? Like,
it is
compared to where you were even a year or two or three or four or 5 years ago for most people. So I think once you get to the phase where, you know, whether you're an individual or an organization or a company or a country, once you get to the point where where the hard work doesn't equal results, no matter how hard you try, it has a really poor cycle. It has a really intense psychological effect on
people. Start to lose faith that they can, through hard work,
get anywhere
position in life.
Yeah. So I think, I think a lot of this has to do with housing prices and inflation, right? Like, the CPI numbers have gotten really bad, especially during the COVID years. And now, you know, they're kind of,
but I think
still a little higher, but even before that, since Y2K, basically, since the millennium, the turn of the century, like, everything has just been exploding in cost and price. And the problem is, it's not that like the prices are high. It's that nobody really knows why. So people are fighting over the reasons why. And that makes the solution seem so far out of reach that it's, like, not even worth trying in the meantime to, like, get to some kind of resolution.
This exhaustion thing, though, like, I see it not just in, I've talked to many people who, let's say, are at the sharp end of the income distribution and who have houses oftentimes paid off in Toronto and whatever, right? But even, like, this kind of post-COVID, what in this question of what the heck am I doing? Why shouldn't I just, like, go and retire and chill? This is a very, very common thing, even among
I think that is such a great observation, which is that fucking everyone I know is just thinking about putting this all behind them.
Yeah,
I am. I mean, like, I was mentioning earlier, I just started a new job, but, like, I really had to, like, sit down and think about it for fucking 2 years. Like, do I actually want to do this?
And that's what I'm saying. You know, like, at the individual level, that's not a big deal. Yeah. You know, like, if you personally feel like, you know what, I've kind of had enough of the rat race.
Yeah.
Look at, you know, fine. But that only is okay if you know, a portion of the society at any given time feels that way. What happens if everyone feels that way all at the same time? And I wonder, actually, if that is the source of inflation to some to a large extent, which is maybe this loss of productivity, which is tied to inflation, is a result of sort of worker exhaustion.
Yeah, you got to incentivize people with way more money, right? And the strikes that are happening right now are also another.
Yes. What makes me doomer, Steve, is that it seems to me that the only real response that the ruling class has in mind is just more fear and more discipline. And they don't know any other way. They can't restore energy. They can only restore fear. And I don't think it's going to work.
Yeah, this is generally in the past where some kind of breakthrough politician has had to show up and fix things.
Yeah, you're not getting a breakthrough at the present time.
Yeah, like FDR or JFK or somebody.
But there had to be a crisis.
Or Reagan. Right?
There had to be
a rallying crisis. And I think that you're talking about I think that the thing with those crises was you were talking about a civilization that was in the grips of fear and maybe confusion. And then you can rally around someone who gives you clarity and confidence. But I think our issue now is not fear and or confusion. I think it's just exhaustion. And I think people just need to fucking rest. And I don't think that the old prescription is going to work this time around. And if they try I really worry that they're just going to make it worse. So
at the risk of being the market shitlib, how does this jive with the unemployment rate being a mid three handle?
Because so many people are just not fucking in the market. They're not labor participation rate is really low.
Participation rate was going down for many years there's a demographic.
Long-term trend is down.
Long-term trend is down, but it has stabilized. I think around 66.
It will, it's stabilized at a low level, especially young men, right?
It's stabilized at a lower level.
Dudes just don't give it
at that sort of fixed level. The unemployment rates come way down. The median, I'm still of the view, and this is perhaps like quote unquote hot take that the median American came out of COVID like actually pretty okay. Housing equity's out. They got a bunch of transfers from the government.
Yeah. Well, we're not in a total crater of an economy.
I think to believe that is market shitlibbery at its finest, though. I don't think Americans came out of COVID well at all.
It can't all be vibes.
If you look at it from pure cash being spent, then it wasn't an unmitigated disaster.
Cash in the bank, equities are still up since COVID. Value of housing equity is way up.
Dude, but you're it's like you're
this is like being stuck in a job you hate that pays a lot. Right,
welcome to life.
You can be doing fine on paper and making a lot of money, but if you're miserable, the problem is
Americans want too much. They want to jump with meaning.
You know, I wouldn't underestimate
$10,000 in the bank, not five.
I wouldn't underestimate the importance of there being a sense of collective project. I think that most people I know need some level of belief, true or not, that their job actually is useful to someone somewhere. Not necessarily like to humanity, but that, you know, they're on any given day, they're actually like helping someone or some thing. Like if I wasn't doing my job, it would be a real problem. You know, and I've had plenty of experiences where I'm getting paid really good money to basically do nothing. And it feels like shit, dude. You don't feel like you're getting away with anything. You're just constantly worried that this can't last.
It's not just can't last, but
I'm not sharpening my skills. I'm just getting lazy.
When it does end, it's going to be double the
pain. It's going to be double the pain because I just got flabby during that time.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So this is why I personally prefer to start companies and work contracts when I'm doing.
That's addressing the second part of it, right? Like I'm getting sort of professionally flabby.
Yeah.
Do you care about the first part?
Yeah, I do. It doesn't have to be I'm like doing God's work, but it has to be like, look, someone needs this. So, you know, someone needs this to get their job done. So, you know, I think people need to know that their job is like not complete waste of everyone's time.
Yeah. Most people want to be needed. Yeah. That's pretty basic, I think.
Yeah. Yep. And I think that, that might be a problem, right now for a lot of people.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of work though is so like process, like process tie. I don't even know the word to describe it. Like everything's put into like MBA style processes where you don't really interact.
Yeah, it's like org chart pinball.
Yeah. So like the people you interact with are not necessarily your quote unquote customers, even if they're internal.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
You know, you're just doing stuff in a system and you don't really have much context in the sense of like, who am I doing this for? What is this for?
It's that movie Brazil, you know, you're a pancreas inside some massive torso. Chemicals come in and I shoot it back out. You know,
I don't want to sound like a psycho, but I was thinking about this for a moment there. Do I need my job to have meaning? Meaning in the sense that like somebody else really needs it and made somebody else's life better.
Use value.
Yeah, I'm not sure I need that beyond because the first part and second part to me are correlated. Beyond the, if I'm doing something completely meaningless, maybe it'll go away in like 2 years.
Well,
I would worry about, but I worry about it from the losing it part, not the, God.
Well, hold on. Like, so I think we all make approximately, at least at the peak times, about the same amount of money, right? The three of us in general, like the same.
Close enough that small differences here.
So yeah. So in other words, it's towards the higher end of like the normal, like have a job kind of income, right?
Yeah.
In those kinds of jobs, somebody is asking you for shit all the fucking time. So you generally know that you're wanted, right? Like if you're sitting there like pondering the existence of or the meaning of what your job is, that means that's like a very rare thing.
Yeah, it means that you're not going to be lasting very long.
Yeah, exactly. For people who make more than like 150, 200 grand, like if you start getting the 3, 4, 5 area, like you're, yeah, when you're gone, people fucking notice for sure.
I don't know. In tech, I think there's a lot of bullshit jobs in the 300,000.
But they don't. I don't know how common that really is.
It might have been uncommon. But
yeah, I don't know how common that really is because first of all, most jobs, even executive level jobs, are stock based. Most of the money comes from stock based compensation because nobody wants to pay the payroll taxes.
Well, this may be a distribution thing that I'm talking about here, but I've heard the printed number for the average salary at Google was $300,000.
Total comp, because for 10 years,
believable.
The average salary
like flew for 10 years, totally believable.
Yeah,
totally believable.
No. I don't think that was a total comp number. I think that was the average salary.
Okay, I mean,
but that might be a thing where someone's blown.
So that's like right at the cusp, right? Like quarter. What'd you say? 300?
300,000.
Yeah, that's like right at the cusp. Yeah. If you're making 5 or 6, people are asking you for shit constantly. Mm-hmm. If you're under that, then you can just kind of sit at your desk and work on some code. That's average, right?
Yeah.
But so if you're I think the tax cutoff is like 165, and then it starts to really explode at like 278,000 or something like that. So if they're paying you over 270, which is like over 300 basically, that means they really, really, really need you there because they're paying all sorts of payroll taxes on the back end, and you're paying all sorts of payroll or income taxes on the front end. So that's where the dividing line is.
You can tell how uneven America is because like sometimes, like I have two reactions to hearing what people make. One sometimes is like, holy shit, they make that much money. And the other reaction is like, how do you even like carry on? Like, you know, like how do you even change the oil in your car or fix a broken window? Like,
yeah, it's a bimodal distribution.
Yeah,
it's
like my two reactions to hearing about people's financial situation is like, what the fuck? How do you make that much money? And what the fuck? How do you have no money?
Right. So it clusters around like 50 and like 500K.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Like most, it's almost exactly one order of magnitude. It's like, okay, 50K, you're like doing the math. Like, how the fuck do I pay for a $900 brake job on 50K when I take home, you know, 39 of that or whatever.
Yeah.
And then, yeah. And then like one order of magnitude on the other end of the, on the distribution at the other hump in the thing. It's like,
yeah.
Okay. How, like, what the fuck do you actually do that justifies, you know, $50,000 a month or whatever?
Yeah. So my doomerism is that, one, you know, I'm thinking about not just my personal situation, which I think is very, personally, I think is very fortunate, but the sort of like overall environment is, you know, you've got to take into account, like, you know, how your median person is doing out there. And I don't think they're doing really well because, like, you know, and frankly, the other thing is like everything's so expensive here. Right. Like, I just don't like just basic shit, like a basic old ass house that no one would dream about living in, but, you know, except for its location is beyond reach. I mean, it's
so crazy. Like, I remember reading on places like Reddit or Hacker News just maybe 10 years ago, how people were shocked to learn how cheap everything was in the US compared to places like Europe or the wealthy parts of Asia. But now it's almost, it hasn't flipped, but
it's gotten
the US is just catching up to the rest of the world now in terms of just how fucking expensive everything is and how much taxes you have to pay for everything.
Yeah, and everything's like, honestly, it's a little shittier than the rest of the world. I know we, like, Americans have such this huge bias to think that we're the most modern and we have the most luxurious lifestyles, but we do not. We just don't. Because anyone who has the wherewithal to go travel to a foreign country realizes pretty quickly we have a shitty lifestyle. Our cities are not attractive.
High-cost lifestyle.
Our public, you know, our just sort of like the public space in America is just
shitty. Yeah, the average life is not as great now.
Yeah.
If you have a ton of money, you can do whatever the fuck you want.
And just civic life, like just public life is just not great. I'm not saying it's a complete disaster, but it's not great. I mean, it's a lot of highways and there's not a lot of public space and there's just not a lot going on. Whereas in other parts of the world, you know, cities are just better designed. They're just more livable and attractive than American cities. And, you know, anyone who has traveled, had the luxury of international travel, has noticed this for sure. Am I wrong? I mean,
that's right. I mean, yeah. I mean, the thing is, in the past, you could paper that over, right, with cheap cars and gas and cheap food and all that stuff. But now it's like, wait a minute, what am I actually, you know, what's the upside?
Yeah, what's the upside?
There really isn't no upside. It's tough to identify what the upside is because now you're paying just as much for now you're not getting as much for the amount of money you pay.
Yeah, there's no happy medium in America. You know, you're either a have or a have not. And I would venture to say that actually that situation for the haves, especially if you're not, I mean, if you're just like barely a have, you know, which I would say we are barely haves compared to what a true have is, right?
Yeah, barely, yeah.
We're barely haves.
We are closer to.
I could wake up tomorrow and shit could be very different.
Yes. Yeah, yes. I for one would trade, my income, my income to a large degree, to live in a society where like everything was better for everyone. I would make that trade not out of a sense of like you know, I want to be a good person, but I think my daily life would be better. Yeah,
totally, totally. No, I totally agree with that.
I don't know if I would, but I would have to think about it.
Yeah, yeah. I personally would rather live in a society where, look, everyone was sort of like financially secure and, you know, there wasn't fucking crime everywhere and poverty everywhere. Like, it felt like a healthy, you know, fair and vibrant society rather
than I see what you're saying.
Things are shitty. Things are falling apart, but I still got my
social
paying job that I don't know how long it's going to last.
That's such a hypothetical, right? Like that's not actually possible.
But there's a lot of places like that.
What, like where though?
Like I think America's like one of the worst places for this. I think a lot of Europe is better. Despite all the gloom and doom we say about Europe, I think a lot of European societies are better at this than we are by far. I think France is better at this than we are. I think even the UK is probably better at this than we are.
UK seems like a shithole, right?
UK seems like a shithole, but I think in a way they're probably better off than America.
Mike, you're going to Europe, right?
I'm going to Italy in 3 days. Yeah.
Oh. Oh, you should do some reporting on the.
Yeah, exactly.
In Rome. I agree with the idea, why do I feel a drive to go and make money? It's not for me. It's so that I can ensure to the best of my ability that my kids are going to have a reasonable enough lifestyle when they grow up so that they can afford a house in a major, you know, tier one metro in the world or whatever. And, you know, all that. And to do that, I have to make sure I send them to a good school in the right major. To do that, I have to make sure I send them to ideally like a private school, right? Have the right friends and so on and so on. Also that they do not fall off the upper middle class train. We worked very, very hard to get into this train, to get into this tier. And it would be irresponsible of me in that view to give it up. So that's why I work. Would I trade that for like a guarantee that my kid's life is going to be pretty okay and pretty okay along with everybody else? Yeah, I would.
What I'm saying is my point is that I think that we're at a moment in the life cycle of our civilization. Let's call it like the North American civilization or whatever, since you're a Canadian, that, you know, we have to really worry about this. Like all my friends who are parents have that same feeling. Like they have to, their main financial stress is to sort of buy the security of their children.
Yes.
And, you know, it just wasn't that way with my parents. You know, they didn't give a shit. They were just like, we're going to throw you in the public school and then you're going to find your way out. And you're gonna. They just threw me into a system that they trusted, and their trust in that system was largely justified because the schools were functional, and as long as we didn't get ourselves, you know, in trouble or whatever, we just did what we were supposed to do, more or less. We didn't have to be exceptional. You just did what the teachers asked you to do. You did what the programs asked you to do, and you just went on the path that, you know. And there was no oversight. My parents weren't like, you know, constantly trying to help guide me through the system. The system had its own built-in guidance system for the students. They actually taught us how to navigate these, you know, how to navigate our own educations. And we did fine. And I don't think that that's like people have trust in that anymore. And they're probably right to not have that trust because I don't think the system works.
But you're highlighting like a very unique time.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. It was a unique time, right? And it was a good, better time.
It was definitely a better time, but like that might have been unique, not just for America, but like in human history.
No. I don't think that's true.
I mean, like you're talking about an era a little bit late for that, but like you're talking about an era where, and there was legitimately an era after the Second World War where like an American could finish high school or sometimes not even finish high school and go and get a job in a Ford plant. Buy a detached house, you know, provide for a family of four on that Ford plant job with no college education and have a stable retirement. That was like what, like the 60s and 70s, 50s, 60s, 70s? So that was kind of like the environment in which your parents didn't grow up in the States, but like that was kind of the world that they and their
extraneous
peers would have inhabited, right? But I think that kind of set of conditions probably is globally and through time very, very rare. All right. So it's like is a
you're saying we're just reverting to the norm.
Yes.
And this is just normal life. I would disagree. I think that America is, it's hard for me to say because I haven't really lived abroad, but I've seen enough and I've heard enough, meaning like in New York City, you'd meet a lot of people who come from abroad.
Yeah.
And they all notice this difference. And the difference is that in America, there just isn't it just really feels like you're on your own here as an individual. There isn't like
there's no social. Yeah.
There's not like this sense of living within a larger society. It's just kind of like one, you know, you're just like your own island. And you know, if you fuck up, you know, that's on you. Like, I hope you have like family to back you up or something, because no one else is going to help you. And it's, there isn't a sense that, you know, you're part of like a larger society that actually gives a shit about you.
I think I mean, throughout American history, that hasn't been uncommon, right? Like, just think of the 1800s.
Yeah, but it's supposed to get 1800s. Better. You know?
Yeah, but I mean, I don't know how that's supposed to happen, right? Like, some kind of social cohesion is not necessarily the outcome of a place like America, right? Like, it can happen in local areas and regions, but not like as a huge country. Like,
yeah,
think of the social demographic dynamics of the late 19th century, like in Staten Island and, or excuse me, what's the
Long Island?
No, the fucking island, Ellis Island. Like, all the people who came in through Ellis Island and Angel Island on the West Coast, like, you know, like, that is America. Like, you're just kind of on your own, and good luck.
I don't know about that. I think that there was a stronger Catholic Church back then. I think there were stronger benevolent societies. I think, if not the government, there were
more binding agents in society.
That was all like heavily ethnic, you know.
Yeah, that was ethnic.
That was all like based around your country of origin and ethnicity and all that stuff.
Yeah, but
like,
there was a setup for it. I mean, I'm just saying that. I think if you look at the problems that people are suffering from, which, for example, like the Surgeon General of the United States has been on this campaign of trying to raise this alarm on people dying out of loneliness. I mean, that's pretty shocking for the fucking Surgeon General to be like, hey, listen, guys, I'm looking at the data and people are dying of fucking loneliness, you know?
What does that mean, though? Like heart attacks or overdoses?
Yeah, I don't know what it means, to be honest. But okay. He's just saying that there's a lot of social indicators that suggest that people are extremely isolated.
I blame video games, but yes, go on.
But there's no simple. I mean,
no. Like, I mean, just look at Japan. They were ahead of us by 20 years in this regard, right?
I guess.
Like their whole like loneliness epidemic started in the 90s.
I guess the my frustration about this is that nobody, when I try and convince people of this, the response is always like, it's always been like this, dude. Like, you know, this is just how it is. And I just don't think it is. I think that there's a lot of evidence to suggest that we're in a new era of isolation. And
I wouldn't say that it's always been like this. I think that there are periods where it's like this.
Yeah, we're in one of them.
America goes in and out of these periods based on what, I don't know, but it's not like a permanent condition where it's irreversible.
No, I don't think it's permanent, but I think that we're going to have to hit rock bottom before it, you know.
Right. By definition, there's always going to be some kind of rock bottom.
Yeah. The question is, what is the American rock bottom going to be? I'm thinking it's pretty bad, dude. What do you think?
Okay. So, yeah, I mean, we're basically back at the fourth turning conversation.
Exactly.
Right?
Like, yeah.
It was the Civil War, then the World War II, then,
yeah,
and, you know, like, that's pretty much it, because America's only 200 and whatever years old.
Like, Steve, so, I guess what I'm saying is, I don't think we're rock bottom. I think if you look at indicators, we're probably fine right now, but I think that the jet is out of fuel, man. And we're coasting. We are trading altitude for speed.
Yeah.
You know?
So we'll hit the ground at 300 miles an hour.
I guess my response is, like, you have no idea how far it is to the bottom.
Exactly. And the farther, the worse it is.
Another way of saying it can get so much worse. Or you don't know. You still don't know how good you actually have.
I think we're insulated. I think the three of us have to admit that we're insulated from seeing the worst of what's going on. But if you're open minded to what people are saying and writing, it's pretty bad.
Well, I mean, I don't know if I'm insulated from the worst. I mean, I'm surrounded by homeless people.
Sam, so am I. I'm just saying whatnot. Personally, so, like our personal lives.
Well, yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. But I mean, yeah, mm-hmm. It's not like we're out of touch in the sense that we can't see it. You know, it's definitely happening and we can definitely see it.
Yeah.
But I mean, okay. So just to take this analogy one step further, you know, if you're zooming towards the ground in an airplane, but you have plenty of altitude, like that's actually getting you closer to a recovery state where you can actually get some airspeed and pull up and like
hopefully
and pull out of the dive, right?
Like hopefully.
It's when you're like in a plane.
Well, you better have a crack pilot to do that. And I don't think we have crack pilots.
Well, yeah. I mean, in a plane, the analogy goes, if you're trying to pull up, you're just going to bleed off speed and then just plummet towards the ground backwards and stall out. But
no, you guys, you still have to hit some kind of crisis moment, like true crisis moment. It's not here yet. Like January 6th was a joke. That was not.
You're only saying that because I think you're still looking at numbers. You want objective proof that we've hit a crisis, and I'm saying
yeah, I think well
the crisis. Look, it may not have peaked, but we know it's here, and it's like getting a cancer diagnosis.
Well, it is.
Maybe you're fine for now, but we know we got the biopsy, and this is serious. That's kind of like how I think of what's going on.
Well, yeah, I guess we're still like yes, we are in crisis vibes, and I'm looking for crisis data. Yes, I am looking for crisis.
Yeah, but you're looking at it in prices. You're looking at it in some of the most artificially manipulated numbers.
Prices aren't good because those are just set at the bargain.
In the economic data that we have, it can't all be just vibes. Like there's doom. Like it is not out of the question that you are simply like this generation's doomsayer, right? Like it could be the case. There could have been doomsayers in the good old days of the 1980s, 1990s for the U.S. as well, right? It's like we don't remember those people.
Yeah. Look, that's the point is that if by the time you get proof of it, it's too late.
That's fair.
So the question, I think it is, look, it is very much like a vibes question, but the issue is, are you just inherently biased against the notion of vibes? Do you think that's a fraudulent thing?
It's not that.
Or are you, you know, do you kind of sense, like, do you have an intuitive sense that something's wrong?
Yeah, I mean, I think we disagree in degree, not in direction. And I'm trying to, like, figure out how much of a degree-based difference we have.
I think one of the differences that you're in Canada, and I do think that things are more attenuated there than they are in the United States.
That might be it. And I haven't
like
been
we are more craven now than you guys.
I also do not. Well, I don't know. Like, I work downtown. I walk around downtown.
Well, you have kids too, right? So you hang out with other parents a lot.
Yeah,
and I definitely don't. So I don't see any of that like optimism. In other
I hang out with a lot of parents and I would not call them an optimistic.
It's not optimism, it's anxiety. It's anxiety.
Anxiety? Okay. Yeah. Well, yeah, I wouldn't know because I don't hang out with parents, but okay. So even with the parents crowd, everyone's anxious.
Yeah, there's absolutely anxiety over okay, is your kid doing well in school? Are they gonna be, you know, this and that? Are they going to be the long-term worry of, are they going to get into a good university? Will they be able to afford a house?
Yeah. See, this has a lot to do with why I don't want or aren't planning on having kids. I'm not planning on having kids ever because this just seems like a fuckload of shit to worry about. Where in the, like my generation, it was mainly optimism. Mm. For parents, and now it's mainly it's not pessimism, it's just anxiety.
And, like, and how was that optimism expressed? I think in my community or locale where I grew up, it was mostly parents who weren't really that worried about you. They were just kind of like, yeah, I mean, just do what the system tells you to do. Did the teacher tell you to do that? You do it.
Yeah,
they trusted the schools to educate you. They trusted that the colleges would educate you, and then they trusted that industry would take care of you on the same terms that it took care of them.
My parents trusted the system, I think, to a fault. Like they put way too much faith in the school system. But yeah, that was the default. That's what everyone
did. Now the default is I don't trust the schools at all.
Yeah.
And so I just don't think parenting today is the same as it was for our parents. Where they could largely just sort of kind of let you be in, you know, brought up by the system.
and it'll work out okay.
And they took care of the bare minimum, and you were sort of managing your own shit, and they'd be fine. Yeah.
It was fine, and the guidance counselor would help you with your college applications. And that was kind of my experience as well. Although I also think it was...
It wasn't perfect. I'm just saying that on balance, it was more like that then than it was than it is now.
Right.
I mean, there were problems back then, but...
I don't know. We could also just be thinking of it that way because we survived it. And there totally could be a survivorship bias thing here too, right? Like we all went to university, right? It all worked out.
I think the big thing was fine. I think the big thing that I struggle with in trying to bring my message of doom to the people is this sort of reflexive gaslighting that I get. Which is fair. I'm not saying it's not fair, but it is the response often is the gaslighting to say, are you sure it's not just you? And I took that question very seriously. I mean, it could just be me, but I'm constantly double checking myself. Like I'm constantly benchmarking myself against what other people are saying.
Yeah.
I'm constantly thinking of like, am I able to actually make predictions that are accurate from my attitudinal orientation?
Yeah.
Or am I completely out of whack and I just – no, I – like my doomerist view about America allows me, I think, to actually interpret the news more accurately than I would otherwise. I can sense what's going on better because I'm more open-minded to the fact that things are a lot worse than people are saying. And so, you know, what's going – like say, for example, what happened with that last Fed announcement where suddenly the markets got spooked?
Yeah,
because they started realizing, wait, shit, they're not going to drop rates. Yeah.
This is so serious.
You're starting to see the reinversion of the curve. That doesn't surprise me. I've been taught this is exactly what you would expect if you started to understand, like, you know, just how serious a problem the ruling class sees things, like what I'm saying is my doomerism, I'm probably just picking up on the vibes that I think the ruling class is at the very, very top, how they feel about things. I think they are in a state of panic.
With the ruling class, like the people who control the interest rate, that type of person?
The capital.
The capitalist class. I think the Fed is largely, you know, just sort of an organ of that class,
right. So they're kind of projecting the feelings of that.
I mean, the interest that they're protecting is a specific type of hierarchical economic management system in America that to them is inviolable. This is America. So you have to reinstill worker discipline through increased worker precarity. And this is on the record. I don't think I'm engaging in any sort of speculative fantasy.
They would just use different words to describe it. But
they use worker insecurity.
They will say, like, they won't frame it as like a, and they probably won't even believe that this is, you know, like, I don't think Jerome.
Well, they call it maximum employment, which
maximum, like the maximum stable rate of employment and stable prices. Right.
I'm talking about Janet Yellen's paper. I'm talking about Alan Greenspan's speech to Congress about, how do we have such low inflation if we have such low unemployment? And his response was, we still think there's a lot of worker insecurity baked into the system despite the low unemployment rate. And that is a magical state of affairs.
Greenspan was a bit of a dick, but
just being honest.
In retrospect.
Yeah.
But like even without this, like I don't think Powell goes to bed thinking, oh, shit, I got to make some more worker insecurity.
I think he does. Absolutely he does.
Hold on.
Think he's worried that the economy is overheating an engine?
Yes. Yes, I do.
He thinks that the workers are getting uppity. That's what overheated economy
is. He doesn't want a wage price spiral. Because that will lead to multiple waves of inflation, and that's how they'll frame it. It's a different logic to get to the same conclusion.
Their pet economic theories are just as abstract and bullshit to them as to us. They have real concerns.
I pretty much agree with Dean, except so right now I think the wrinkle is that unions are resurgent, right?
And yes.
Oh my god,
they're striking left and right
every day. Well, low point, but they are resurgent.
Yeah, they're right. Trying to come back, and yeah. They're trying to exert their power again.
And that is the real fly in the ointment. So, if that gets going,
yeah, we're set for a showdown, basically, yes, right? Yes, between the powers that be and labor again.
It's not just labor. It's not. See, this is the thing. I think vibes are under. We think that we're being smart by ignoring vibes, when in fact I think the ruling class is very attuned to vibes. And I think when they start sensing that the vibe in the air is, you know, like, for example, like, what's behind this UAW demand for 40% raises? You know where that came from? Why are they asking for 40% raises? It's because the CEO got a 40% raise.
Oh, okay.
So they're saying, if that fucking person gets 40%, we want 40%. That's a vibes-based negotiation there. That's a fuck you, right?
Like,
they know they're
that.
Not getting 40%.
Sure.
They're saying, go fuck yourself. If you think that you can keep paying your fucking CEO like this and screwing us, then watch, see who really deserves, like, see how much a 40% pay raise to the CEO is going to get you in terms of...
See the real cost.
It's a vibe. This is not... just the simple, you know, let's rebalance, let's have a COLA adjustment, right? This is a fuck you to the ruling class, and they know that. They know that this is a fuck you. They know that there is a vibe in the air where it's an anti-elite. There's real worker resentment. There's a hatred of the elites.
So what do you think is going to be the fuck you to? The fuck you back?
To them, and they're going to destroy the economy.
To the strikes,
they're going to throw people out on the street.
Okay,
they're going to move. They're going to be like, it's like what Reagan did. They're just like, okay, well then, fuck you. Then we're moving your job to Mexico.
Yeah, that is.
Maybe we can find a Mexican that appreciates the job more than you, motherfucker. And they have no qualms doing that, and they're already setting it up, so they're going to blame China for it or whatever. They've got a million ways to manipulate the media and distract and lie and obfuscate about what's really going on. I'm telling you, man, and I'm not like I've never called myself a leftist, and I'm not even sure I'm supportive of the unions here, but I get it. I mean,
yeah, it's pretty clear what's going on. I mean,
this
yeah,
is vibes, think, yeah, dude.
All right, that's the that.
It's vibes. It's
political zeitgeist. No. That I would agree. Like, if there is a, if they can get something, even if they get 20, honestly, like 40, I get is just a negotiating position. That will. There's been a couple of these wins, right? Like the pilots, UPS, Kaiser Permanente going on strike now.
Yeah, Kaiser.
During
COVID, the
problem.
I'm pretty sure that the longshoremen dock workers went on strike at some point.
Yeah, that's true, dude. Yeah. And that led to like the whole like 100 ship backlog or whatever.
What I'm saying is, I think that if this was just regular union activity where they just wanted a pay increase, to catch up,
well, that's just normal shit.
That's just normal shit, and that wouldn't bother them too much.
No, but like they're fine with that.
This is like, wait, these people are mad.
Actually, what was GM's GM's counteroffer?
20%.
Actually, I'm curious. 20%?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, they already went for 20%.
And they said fuck you.
Oh, right.
the union rejected 20%?
Yeah, you know, because I think part of this is it's not a negotiation. This is a rebellion. And this is what I'm saying about people in America is like they're dude. Jan 6 was no joke, man. I mean, I know it's a silly looking thing, but it was a pretty insane thing to happen. And
yeah, it never happened before.
Never happened before. Like
the
dude, we are shit libs. Do you understand? We are still like, look at him. Look at his face. My life's pretty good. I don't know, man. I think you're just. Making shit up.
Was it really like that?
Dude, people are insane.
Wasn't Jan 6 really just like the leftist media trying to make the Trumpists look bad?
Dude, you need... See, this is why you need to leave the country. Because when the shit really does hit the fan, you are going to be marched through the streets in fucking...
No. No, no.
Yeah, there was also that thing in, what was it, the trucker strike in Canada?
Yeah, oh, yeah, the trucker strike? That was against like vaccines or masks.
Oh yeah, that was the COVID stuff. Okay. Yeah.
There's a new strike that was announced today. Was it the
Canada?
No, in the U.S. there was another big one. I forgot what sector it was.
I was also mentioning the Hollywood strike is still going on.
Hollywood strike's still going on. There was a UPS strike or something like that?
Yeah.
The UPS got their demands. Okay. The drivers got their demands on that one. But they were threatening to like shut down. Dude, that's like half the packages.
Yeah.
In the fucking economy. That would have been really bad.
No, here's the thing. I mean, if they all get their pay raises, yeah, there is an inflationary problem. And I think that they're correct in assessing this wage price spiral thing or whatever.
Yes.
But more important than that is the vibes. I think more important. That's why I'm saying I think that what they're doing with rates is a subtle form of class WMD. Meaning, okay, if it comes down to it, we're going to nuke the whole fucking economy because we will survive and you won't. We will win a war of attrition. Trust us.
Right, because we have so much
capital, dude.
Doesn't even matter.
And trust me, we have no class solidarity too. If that means that we have to sacrifice some of our own, fuck it. That's fine. But at the end of the day, I got the chips. I'm going to survive this. And we can go through a whole fucking decade of pain and misery if need be. But you're going to get back in line. And I think that's the plan. And here's the thing. I don't know if it's going to work. Meaning, like, I don't know if their WMD plans of class warfare is actually going to work. Because I think people are... I think they're crazy. I think people are I don't think that's we're just going to go to fucking Reaganism again. I think we might do a real Jan 6. Like, you know, that was just a dress rehearsal.
It's like this whole pendulum thing, right? You never de-Reaganized yet. You haven't de-Reaganized. Right? In the sense that, like,
well, based on the union activity we have.
Not yet. Well, I don't know, but it's not like labor power is increasing, but it is not like it was in the 70s.
I don't think that politically it's just as easy to crush labor anymore as it is. I think that there is a populist sentiment in the air, and they've got to be careful about crushing labor.
But I'm not comparing to like 2015. I'm comparing to like 1975, right? The degree of labor power in 1975, I think, still exceeds.
No, I'm saying that people were ready to say fuck you to the labor unions at that point.
Because they have gone through so much shit.
Yeah, and people were just tired of the blue collars, whatever.
Right now,
I don't think that's the issue. I don't think people are tired of the blue collars. I think people are like, yeah, hey, if they're going to organize and say fuck you to the man, well, they're kind of expressing how I feel too. So I'm not really against these people.
Yeah, people hate white collar now these days. White collar professionals.
Yeah,
like they fucking hate that class of people.
Yeah.
You know, basically. I mean,
and white collars are going to get sacrificed, dude. That's the other thing. There's going to be a bloodbath for the white collars, especially the precarious ones.
Yeah, this is the PMC culling,
dude. I mean, Mike, to your point, like about not having, like, that's part of the reason I have never in my entire career felt like I was actually on solid ground here in terms of like the value proposition that I brought to the table. I was like, a lot of this sounds like bullshit, bubbly privilege. I feel like I'm just skating on privilege right now. I should not be being paid this amount. And you know, I've never been a comp guy. I've never been the type to like really harp on, you know, honestly, look, I've made in my career as a lawyer, I've made anywhere between $145,000 and $400,000+ a year, and it never made a goddamn bit of difference to me. I didn't feel different about showing up to work. In fact, the one time when I was making $145,000 a year, that was like one of my favorite jobs.
Well, yeah. So as someone who's made very little money and also a lot of money, it's in any given year, there's no correlation between your enthusiasm for the job or your or your life.
Right?
There's no correlation between happiness and
no.
Yeah. As long as your base bills are paid,
then, a certain number.
Yeah.
Yeah. I liked my job, meaning like it was I felt like I was doing a real work of some meaning. Yeah. Whatever. So, I felt fine.
Right.
I didn't care how much it was.
And this isn't like groundbreaking conversation, but I think that the problem is in the last 10 years, a lot of people have anchored their expectations towards these super high salaries and comp packages. And there is a real risk of an entire generation of people, let's say from age 35 to like 55, who are going to get fucking cratered.
Yeah. I mean, look, if I had more faith in the system as being one that was actually functional and therefore I could depend on my, like, you know, I felt like my career made sense and like my job made sense in a system that should last, it was durable. I'd be fine making like, you know, I'd be fine making on the lower end of the spectrum of what I've made throughout my career and say, you know, that's pretty much where I am. I'm not going to make a lot more than that. Maybe like modest increases over time. But if I enjoyed my job and I thought it was durable, I'd be a lot more committed to sort of long-term planning under that than I am now, where depending on like what environment, like what kind of job I want to take, I can vary my comp a lot. And yeah, none of it seems very durable to me.
I've got more of a mercenary mindset, and that's basically not the standard, especially in technology these days. Because
you think most tech people are like do-goody kind of?
Yeah, they're so tech used to be the industry itself used to be where all the rejects went. Okay, and then but then over the past 10 years, that's where all the fucking high flyers went. Like all the brand name school people went into tech instead of finance and law and consulting.
Yeah.
But that's not the normal state of affairs for the technology industry. It's where all the fucking weirdos were supposed to, you know, that's where we all ended up in the 80s and 90s.
But it was still a product based.
Yeah. But it goes through waves, right? Like back in the day, like all of the fucking straight laced people ended up at IBM and AT&T.
Yeah.
And so it goes through waves.
Redefinition of what the industry is, right?
What's that?
Some of it is a redefinition of what the industry is, too, right? Like we just say, like, oh, this is the tech sector, but the tech sector does.
Yeah, it's so like, because what are you doing? You're automating other industries, basically. So, like, fintech is really just finance.
Yes.
And, you know, automation of industrial stuff or whatever is really just manufacturing. And, you know, law, legal tech is basically just law. So there's a lot of like different, there's a lot of different ways to interpret what technology is, but for the longest time in like, let's say the 80s and 90s, like that's not where people wanted to end up. and now it might be headed back in that direction, at least for my industry.
Should we continue this as a bonus part of the pod, because we're at an hour 20.
Sure.
Let's go for it.
That's the end of part one of a two-part podcast. The second part is on our Patreon. If you want to listen to it and support our Patreon, go to patreon.com/planamac.